So for decades, right, metallurgists basically treated the whole process of making different steel structures like a cookbook.
Oh, absolutely.
If you're forging a blade and you want that extreme brittle hardness of martensite, you flip to page 10, follow the specific cooling recipe, and you're good.
Yeah, heat to X, quench at Y. Very empirical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you needed like the toughness of bainite instead, you just flip to a different page. And the assumption was always that these microstructures were just, they were entirely separate beasts.
Right. Completely different phenomena governed by different rules.
But then in 1987, these three researchers published a paper that essentially took that cookbook and just threw it in a fire. They proved that every single time you manipulate steel, it's actually governed by this one silent microscopic negotiation. Welcome to the deep dive, by the way. Today we're going all the way down to the atomic level.
Down to the crystal lattice, yeah. We're looking at a pretty landmark conference paper here by G.B. Olson, H.K.D.H. Padicia, and M. Cohen. It's called Coupled Diffusional and Displacive Transformations.
Quite a mouthful.
It is, yeah. But you're spot on about its impact on the field. Because before this, like you said, it was all trial and error. You heat the alloy, you cool it, you look under a microscope to see what you got.
Just writing down results.
Right. But this paper shifted that entire paradigm. It gave us a mathematically rigorous model to explain, well, it's basically a grand unified theory of how crystals transform in steel.
Which is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We really want to decode this academic paper for you and figure out what is actually happening when metal changes its inner architecture.
And to understand that, you have to look at the exact thermodynamic mechanics, how the atoms are literally negotiating for space when the temperature shifts.
And that negotiation is the central conflict of the paper, right?
Yeah.
Because we're watching two completely different physical processes trying to happen in the exact same physical space. We're talking about the transformation from the gamma phase, which is called austenite, into the new alpha phase, the ferrite. And we have to introduce the two dancers in this atomic system.
Right, the iron matrix and the carbon atoms.
Yeah. So, just to give a relatable analogy here for you listening, imagine you have this old brick building and you need to reshape it. There are basically two ways you could do that.
Okay, I like this.
You could take it apart brick by brick, move each brick individually across the yard, and rebuild it. That's diffusion, right? Atoms migrating individually over distances.
Yes, individual random walk.
Or the other option, you could just get a bunch of bulldozers and shove the walls so they all sort of tilt into a new shape at the exact same time.
Like a synchronized shift.
Right. And that's called displacement. It's this military-style synchronized shift of the whole atomic lattice at once.
And that right there is the core issue. The iron atoms, they inherently want to do that displacive shift. They want to snap into the new lattice geometry all at
To
once.
shove the walls over.
Exactly. But steel has what we call the carbon problem. Steel is an interstitial alloy, which means you've got these little carbon atoms just wedged in the empty spaces between the larger iron atoms.
Right, so they're just hanging out in the hallways of our brick building.
Yeah, and when the iron lattice tries to do that massive synchronized structural shear, the carbon atoms are physically in the way of the machinery.
They're blocking the walls from tilting.
Exactly. So suddenly the speed of this whole transformation is bottlenecked by two competing forces.
You've got the intrinsic mobility of the iron boundary itself, like how fast the iron can physically snap into the new geometry.
Right.
And that is just constantly colliding with the slow diffusional scurrying of the carbon atoms that are just desperately trying to get out of the way.
Which is why the paper's title uses the word coupled. These two things, the displacive shear of the iron and the diffusional clearing of the carbon, they are inextricably linked. Nature has to somehow pay for both of them at the exact same time.
Which brings up the most natural question. If these two totally different processes are happening simultaneously, how does the metal decide how fast to actually change?
Well, it all comes down to an energy budget. Every single atomic movement requires energy. And in this system, the total currency that the system has to spend is the net free energy.
Which the paper represents as delta G,
Yeah.
right?
Delta G. That is the available driving force pushing the whole transformation forward.
So it's basically the operating budget for our atomic renovation.
A very, very strict operating budget. And the paper proposes this beautifully simple equation for it. Delta G equals GD plus GID.
Okay, let me pause you there because I was looking at this delta G budget in the source material, and well, I'm going to push back a little because something wasn't adding up for me.
Oh, guess here.
If the iron is violently shearing into a new lattice shape, that physical strain has to cost a massive amount of energy, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you're tearing the old structure, you're creating a new physical boundary. The metal is literally distorting. Are you saying the rent for all of that physical strain is being paid out of this one delta G operating budget?
That's actually a brilliant catch. And it touches on a really crucial distinction the authors make in the math. That physical strain you're talking about, that's known as the stored energy of the martensitic shear.
Stored energy, okay.
Yeah. And the paper explicitly notes that during the initial nucleation phase, when the crystal is just starting to form, that stored energy actually exceeds 700 joules per mole.
Wait, 700 joules per mole? Just to physically distort the lattice?
Just for the physical distortion. It is an enormous thermodynamic penalty. But to answer your question, no. That is not included in the delta G budget.
Really? So where does the 700 joules come from?
It's paid for before we even look at delta G. The total chemical driving force of the system has to cover that massive penalty first. Delta G is exclusively defined as the net free energy that's left over.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's purely the discretionary operating budget. It's the money left over to actually move the atoms and clear the carbon after the fixed costs of the physical strain are already paid.
Okay, that clarifies the math so much. The strain is just the overhead cost.
Exactly.
And delta G is what we actually have left in the wallet to spend on velocity. And so that equation, delta G equals GD plus GID, it's splitting that leftover budget into two separate bills.
Right. G pays for the diffusion of the carbon, and GID pays for the interface itself to move.
Mm-hmm.
The energy is constantly being dissipated by these two processes acting in tandem.
Right. But knowing the budget doesn't automatically tell us the speed, right? Like, how do we actually calculate how fast this process happens?
That is where the paper does this brilliant mathematical trick. To find the actual velocity of the advancing boundary, Olson, Badesia, and Cohen isolated the variables.
Isolated them how?
By calculating two completely separate theoretical speed limits.
Theoretical, meaning like, how fast it would go in a perfect vacuum if only one of those constraints existed.
Precisely. First, they calculated VEED. This is the hypothetical velocity if the diffusion of carbon was the only thing holding it back.
Yeah.
Like assuming the iron lattice could just snap into place with zero friction.
Right.
And then they calculated VEED. This is the velocity if the interface mobility was the only issue, assuming the carbon could just instantly teleport out of the way.
Without requiring any energy.
Exactly.
It's honestly a lot like a three-legged race.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, like one leg is the structural shift of the iron and the other leg is the carbon diffusion. And you mathematically cannot run faster than your slowest leg.
No, you can't.
The actual real-world velocity, which we just call V, has to occur at the exact point where V equals V.
Right, because the system is forced into an equilibrium. You see this in figure 3 of the paper. They mapped this exact intersection.
They plotted it out.
Yeah, they ran the calculations for an iron alloy with 0.4% carbon by weight.
Mm.
And they plotted these VEED and VEED curves to show the real-world growth speeds across varying levels of supersaturation.
Okay, let's actually talk about that, the supersaturation. Because when we say the carbon is diffusing out of the way, it's not just like evaporating into thin air.
No, it has to go somewhere.
The advancing ferret boundary, the new crystal, it's basically acting like a snowplow, isn't it?
The snowplow effect is the perfect way to visualize it. Ferrite has a very, very low solubility for carbon compared to the old austenite phase. It just doesn't have room for it.
So it kicks it out.
Yeah, as the ferrite lattice grows, it physically rejects the carbon atoms, pushing them ahead of the boundary and dumping them into the remaining austenite.
Which means the austenite right in front of the snowplow is suddenly just getting crammed with extra carbon atoms.
Exactly. That local pileup at the interface is the supersaturation, and it causes a massive problem for our thermodynamic budget.
Because it gets harder to push more snow onto an already giant pile of snow.
Right. The chemical potential gradient shifts. Pushing more carbon into that saturated area gets exponentially harder, which means the greed portion of our budget, the cost to diffuse the carbon, starts skyrocketing.
And if greed skyrockets, that means we have less energy available for GID.
Yes.
So the interface mobility drops and the whole three-legged race is forced to slow down just to maintain that balance between VEED and VI.
Which really highlights the elegance of this coupled model. The velocity isn't just some arbitrary number. It's a continuously recalculating response to that physical pileup of carbon.
It's brilliant. But, you know, plotting these theoretical speeds on a graph is great in theory. The real question is, what happens when you actually heat up or cool down the steel in the real world?
Right. How does temperature change the game?
Exactly. And the paper points to a highly specific temperature metric for this 0.4% carbon alloy. 397 degrees Celsius.
Yes.
They call it the calculated Martensitz-Sturt temperature. So what makes 397 degrees the magic number? What's happening there?
Well, to understand the significance of 397 degrees, we really have to look at the data from Figure 4, which analyzes transformations between 410 degrees and 530 degrees Celsius.
So just slightly above that Martensite line?
Right. And what they found is that at those lower temperatures, the initial nucleation event, like the very birth of the new crystal, is entirely diffusionless.
Wait, entirely? Meaning the iron lattice just violently shears into the new geometry and the carbon doesn't even have a millisecond to get out of the way.
Exactly. The driving force is so high and the temperature is low enough that the carbon just gets completely trapped inside the new structure.
It just snaps around it.
Yeah, it's a purely displacive event. V is totally dictating the action. But here's the crucial nuance the paper reveals. The rules for nucleation, starting the transformation, are not the same as the rules for growth.
Okay, so once the crystal is born, things change.
Yes. Once it starts to expand, the paper shows what they call C-curve nucleation kinetics.
C-curve. So the relationship between the temperature and the speed of the transformation isn't just a straight line.
Far from it. I mean, common sense would tell you that as you cool a material down, the atomic activity just uniformly slows down, right?
Right. Colder usually means slower.
But the math here shows that as the temperature decreases, the velocity of the phase transformation actually speeds up, hits a maximum peak, and then aggressively slows down.
Drawing a C shape on the graph.
Drawing a C, exactly.
Because we're actually balancing two opposing forces, right?
Yeah.
As the temperature drops, the iron gets thermodynamically desperate to change its phase. The driving force is spiking.
Yes.
But at the exact same time, the dropping temperature is stripping away the thermal energy that the carbon needs to be able to move.
You've hit the nail on the head. You have this increasing thermodynamic demand crashing into a decreasing physical capability.
So that peak of the C curve, that's the sweet spot.
The ultimate sweet spot. It's the exact temperature where the iron has enough driving force to push fast. And the carbon still has just enough thermal mobility to get out of the way.
And if you drop below that peak?
The loss of diffusion just completely overwhelms the system and the transformation grinds to a halt.
Wow. The complexity of that interplay is just staggering. And I want to highlight something fascinating the authors point out. There's an anomaly at exactly 440 degrees Celsius where this relationship gets even weirder, right?
Oh, the 440 degree anomaly.
Yes. At that specific temperature, the correlation between the velocity and the carbon concentration becomes highly complex. It basically shows that nucleation and growth are playing by totally different rules depending on the heat.
It's actually a beautiful piece of evidence for their model. At 440 degrees, the chemical driving force is just high enough to force that diffusionless nucleation we talked about.
So the crystal is born by trapping the carbon.
Right. But the millisecond that initial birth is complete, the parameters shift, the huge physical strain of the nucleation has been paid, the energy budget rebalances, and suddenly the advancing boundary during the growth phase is moving just slowly enough that the carbon actually has time to partition.
Oh, wow. So the crystal is essentially born as martensite, trapping the carbon, but as it glows, it starts acting more like ferrite, pushing the carbon ahead of it.
Exactly. It proves that the nature of the transformation can literally change in real time. The Veed and Vi curves are dynamically recalculating based on the immediate environment.
Which brings us right back to the ultimate payoff for you listening. We started this deep dive by talking about burning the cookbook.
Right.
We've gone through all this math, the carbon snowplow, the temperatures, but what is the grand conclusion here? How does this unify our understanding of all these different steel structures, like bainite and Woodman-Stettin ferrite?
This is the real aha moment of the paper. For centuries, metallurgists categorized these structures by how they looked under a microscope.
Right. Martensite formed at low temperatures and was super hard and brittle.
Bainite formed at intermediate temperatures had this feathery look to it.
And Woodman-Stettin ferrite formed at higher temperatures with those distinct plate-like structures.
Right. And because they look different, they were treated as completely distinct phenomenological events.
Isolated chapters in the recipe book.
But the coupled model proved they aren't entirely separate phenomena. They are all driven by the exact same displacive mechanism. The iron lattice is always executing a shear transformation.
The only thing changing is the carbon.
Exactly. The only difference is the degree of carbon partitioning, which is dictated by how the temperature shifts that Vede and V intersection. It's a continuous spectrum.
So let's trace that spectrum. If we're at the very bottom, below that 397-degree martensite start line, thermal energy is so low that diffusion basically doesn't exist.
The Vede curve is flatlined.
So the iron shears, the carbon is entirely trapped, and that creates massive internal stress, which is why martensite is so hard, but also so brittle.
The extreme end of the spectrum. No partitioning at all. Now, move up the temperature scale into the bainite region.
Okay, so we have more thermal energy now. The carbon has a fighting chance. So the iron displaces, some carbon gets trapped, but a significant portion manages to escape into the surrounding austenite.
And because it partitions into the austenite, it eventually supersaturates that local area until the carbon basically precipitates out as carbide particles right between the ferroplates.
Which is what gives bainite that unique balance of strength and toughness.
Exactly. The core mechanism didn't change at all, only the V variable increased.
And then if we push the temperature even higher up into the Widmanstetten ferret zone, we're giving the carbon a massive amount of thermal mobility.
The Vede curve becomes incredibly robust there. The iron still shears to form the plates, but the boundary moves at a rate entirely controlled by the rapid diffusion of the carbon.
The carbon outruns the snowplow effortlessly.
Almost complete partitioning, yes.
It fundamentally reshapes how you visualize the material. I mean, martensite, bainite, Widmanstetten ferret, they aren't separate reactions. They're just different coordinates on a single thermodynamic map.
It replaced empirical chaos with profound mathematical order. This model proves that diffusion and displacement, they aren't mutually exclusive. They are inextricably coupled forces, balancing each other millisecond by millisecond.
It's just a stunning piece of intellectual work. You take this ancient, forceful, very human process of forging steel, and it gets stripped down to this silent, elegant calculus of energy and atomic friction.
It really is beautiful.
It forces you to reconsider the structure of, you know, every bridge, every skyscraper, every car chassis you see. They're all holding together because of this invisible, mathematically mandated compromise between iron snapping into place and carbon getting out of the way.
And, you know, the implications of that compromise, they actually offer a deeply fascinating lens to look through, even entirely outside of metallurgy.
Oh, how so?
Well, the paper shows us that at the atomic level, nature handles directly conflicting demands, right? Like the need to shift structure instantly versus the slow frictional reality of clearing out obstacles it handles them, not by picking a winner.
It doesn't just choose displacement over diffusion.
Right. It doesn't force the displacive shift to completely override the reality of the carbon. Nor does it let the slow diffusion completely halt the shift. Instead, it finds the precise mathematical intersection where both forces can move forward together at their maximum allowable limit.
The ultimate equilibrium.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder, where else in your life, whether it's, you know, navigating complex team dynamics at work or executing long-term city planning or even just managing your own personal habits, where are you treating a problem as an absolute either or choice?
Wow.
When you feel stuck between the desire to make a rapid structural change and the slow, necessary groundwork of moving the obstacles in your way, maybe you don't actually have to choose one over the other.
Maybe it's a coupled transformation.
Exactly. It might just be a coupled transformation waiting for you to stop fighting the friction and find the exact intersection where both can move forward.
That is a brilliant thought to leave off on. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey down to the microscopic grid, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.